Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
It'll start getting cooler.
Science and skepticism.
You just watch.
I wish science agreed with you.
Hey, well, I don't think science knows, actually.
Our understanding evolves over time. How can we explain that to impatient people who want to undermine science?
Well, maybe we could give them a quick lesson on probability.
Okay, but how can you talk to someone who doubts that the Earth is round?
Listen very carefully. The Earth is flat, gentlemen. That's right, it's flat as a table.
Knowing the limits of science, how can we remain confident in our beliefs?
I'm not a scientist, nor am I a physicist.
I'm not a scientist.
What the world needs now is less science skepticism. How can we make that happen?
Our guest is Michael Shermer, author of Giving the Devil His Due, Reflections of a Scientific Humanist.
Science and Skepticism.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Why do so many people believe in conspiracy theories?
Do we need to evaluate the evidence for ourselves?
Or should we just trust the experts?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about science and skepticism.
You know, I think people are too skeptical about science. They don't believe in climate change. They refuse to wear a mask in the supermarket. And when you show them evidence they're wrong, they don't believe you.
Well, I don't think that they're skeptical enough. A lot of them believe that there's a global conspiracy of people lying about that stuff in order to get research money. I mean, if they're so skeptical, why do they believe their own conspiracy theories? They should learn more science and think for themselves.
that's really nice. That's a great point about people not being skeptical of their own skepticism. But still, Ray, is science actually going to solve that? I mean, sometimes teaching people facts just makes them even more committed to conspiracy theories.
Well, yeah, but science isn't just about reciting facts. It's about thinking critically. It's about evaluating the evidence for yourself.
But how is a layperson supposed to evaluate the evidence for something as complicated as climate change? I mean, it would take me years to become a climate expert. Don't I have to trust the scientists?
Okay, maybe lay people can't do original research, but they can still read scientific articles and think for themselves.
Well, you can't always get those things for free. And even if you do, how do you know you're understanding them?
Okay, fine. But a layperson could still read science news articles. Ones that are written for a general audience.
Those general news audience articles? You gotta admit, some of those are biased, sensational, or just plain confused.
An educated person should be able to spot the bias by reading carefully and by asking the right questions.
Right, an educated person. But to get an education, you have to trust the experts. You rely on your science teacher. Your science teacher relies on a textbook. And the textbook relies on original research published by scientists. I don't think any one of us can do that independently.
Okay, you're right that people can't learn science alone. But we still need to be critical thinkers. Because sometimes scientists make mistakes. Sometimes they even lie. How about Andrew Wakefield and how he made up a bunch of stuff about vaccines causing autism?
Oh, man, yeah, that guy has a lot to answer for.
Yep. So that's why we need to keep our wits about us, even when we're reading articles in science journals. Skepticism is how scientists keep themselves honest.
You know what? That's a really good point. I'm going to grant you that skepticism is really good for scientists, but not everyone's a scientist.
Well, ordinary people can be scientists too, and they should be. Just think about all those citizen science websites where ordinary people pool their information about bird populations, or classify galaxies based on telescope images and sky surveys.
Oh, I love those websites. But still, I don't know. I mean, anyone can gather data, sure, but that's not the same as deciding which questions to study in the first place, or like making a real life decision based on scientific results. I still think some things are best left to the experts.
Yeah, but even if you can point to the experts, how are you going to get people to believe them?
Well, what if you could use faith to fight skepticism about things like social distancing and wearing masks? we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to meet one pastor who's trying to do just that. She files this report.
It can be difficult to argue with people skeptical of mainstream science. They often use personal experience and logic to reach questionable or flat-out untrue conclusions. Like in this clip from the 1939 version of The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
The earth isn't round, it's flat.
How do you know?
I've observed it in all my travels over Europe. It's flat, everywhere it's flat.
Oh, let's listen to the play.
Flat earthers are less of a public health concern than people skeptical about the risks of COVID-19. During a Senate hearing on reopening the economy, Senator Rand Paul passed along some feedback to Dr. Anthony Fauci.
All I hear, Dr. Fauci, is we can't do this, we can't do that, we can't play baseball. Well, even that's not based on the science. We need to not be so presumptuous that we know everything.
And at the core of a lot of this lockdown skepticism is a deep distrust of institutions. We're told to trust the science, but throughout history, the medical field has exploited marginalized communities.
They rightly are skeptical.
Terrace King is a pastor at Liberty Grace Church of God in Baltimore.
They're skeptical because of the continuous unequal treatment that they've received, not through stories just of Tuskegee in the past.
He's referring to the 40-year research study known as the Tuskegee Experiment. In that study, Black men infected with syphilis were deliberately left untreated so federal officials could study the disease.
That's always the story that's brought up. But today there's unequal treatment in hospital systems. They have seen, heard, and witnessed unequal treatment in the healthcare system.
King is a pastor in a part of Baltimore hit hard by COVID-19, and he often turns to scripture to combat skepticism about science.
There is a connection between Jerusalem and Athens. Intellectualism, as in Athens, is not at odds with the faith of Jerusalem.
One example is the story of Noah's Ark.
My father Enoch told me that one day, if man continued in his ways, the Creator would annihilate this world.
So what I saw is true. All life blotted out because of what man has done.
A leader took an approach to save himself and his family following the instructions of God.
King says it's a story of solid data gathering. While in the ark, Noah sends out a raven to get a sense of whether Earth is habitable. The raven doesn't return, and then he sends out a dove. The dove returns with nothing, then an olive branch, and eventually doesn't return at all, which signals to Noah that Earth is ready for him.
But he still waited to hear the voice of God before he opened that ark.
Another example.
Jesus!
Specifically, Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's there with his disciples, Peter, James, and John. Here's that passage put to song in the musical Jesus Christ Superstar.
Take this cup away from me, for I don't want to taste its poison.
In this text, Jesus needs to distance from them to pray to God to remove the cup of death.
There was something that he was required to do that compelled, that pulled him away from them to be at distance because he had a mandatory requirement to gain strength.
The connection for Terrace King is that we all need to stay physically distant if we want to stay healthy. The church service is still remote, and his congregation understands why. The sermons help, but he wants others to reach out to the community. King preaches a lot about the importance of getting a flu shot, but he's skeptical about the Trump administration's rush to get a COVID-19 vaccine out by the end of the year.
I haven't made any attempt to convince people that they should be more immediately confident in the COVID vaccine.
He says skepticism, at least in this case, may not be a bad thing.
I'd want to know, I'd want to know, my God.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks so much for that inspiring report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about science and skepticism.
We're joined now by Michael Shermer, founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine and prolific author, most recently of Giving the Devil His Due, Reflections of a Scientific Humanist. Michael, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Oh, it's nice to be back.
So, Michael, you've put a lot of effort into debunking pseudoscience, and thank you very much for doing that. Is that purely intellectual? Or do you have a relative who's really into conspiracy theories like I do?
Oh, no, it's quite personal for me and my profession. Really, I've been interested in all these topics, the supernatural, the paranormal, science and religion, God, free will, conspiracy theories, aliens, and so on, since I was in college. And in college, I learned how to think like a scientist, and that made me more skeptical naturally because the evidence for most of these things is not very good. So when I started Skeptic Magazine, I realized there was a niche for specializing in particular claims that most scientists are not trained to evaluate, like firewalking or extraterrestrials or Bigfoot or whatever, because they're busy with their own field. So Skeptic, in a way, is kind of a niche magazine for paranormal claims, supernatural claims, extraordinary claims of any kind, certainly of which conspiracy theories would fit. And really, it also touches on a really super important philosophy of science issue, which is, how do you know what's true? Where's the line of demarcation between science and pseudoscience, say, or between science and non-science or nonsense? And really, all the examples I delve into are examples of that demarcation problem.
That makes sense. I'm wondering if there might be another part of your origin story that you and I have in common. You and I hope you don't mind me saying, we both used to be on the inside of a belief system built on faith and aren't any longer. Do you think that that's helped you sort of understand the way that these systems are constructed?
Oh, for sure. Because I was once a born again Christian, I understand, theological arguments because I used to make them. So, you know, the proofs of God's existence, you know, like Thomas Aquinas's five proofs, you know, I used to make those arguments. And, you know, of course, they were countered in my philosophy classes. And so I learned the counter arguments. And so when I debate theists, yeah, I know exactly where they're coming from. And I also know what it feels like to believe, you know, when you really have faith in something, when you believe something for which the evidence really doesn't support it, but you believe it anyway, I know what that feels like. So I'm sympathetic to most people that believe things that I don't believe. I think most people are not faking or pretending to believe for some ulterior motive. I think most people have the beliefs they proclaim, they hold, they really do hold them. They really do believe it.
So what do you think motivates people to have those beliefs, especially when they contravene a clear scientific consensus like climate change or social distancing?
Yeah, those things are very politically affiliated. So when liberals accuse conservatives of being, you know, the party of stupid and the science deniers and so on, they're not science deniers across most fields. They accept most science. They happily fly on airplanes 30,000 feet in the air because they completely trust engineering and math and physics and so on. Or, you know, they accept the plate tectonics theory of geology and earthquakes and so on. It's when a particular area of science, a branch, is affiliated with the other political party. So, for example, Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth, that put climate change on the map, you know, for which he was duly awarded lots of prizes, also made climate science now a liberal a field, and therefore a liberal belief, let's call it. And therefore, conservatives naturally feel they have to reject it because, you know, Gore was the vice president of the Democratic Party. So, that unfortunately.
And you don't think that predated that film, that division?
Well, it did somewhat, but that highly politicized it. That's what kind of put it on the map. A lot of conspiracy theories about the left and what they were trying to do against free markets and capitalism and that sort of thing. That really launched it. There was some climate denial, I recall, in the 90s, even the late 80s, but it was more underground. And it wasn't quite as politicized.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about science and skepticism with Michael Shermer, author of Giving the Devil His Due, Reflections of a Scientific Humanist.
Why do so many people believe in conspiracy theories? How can we explain science to the public when science is constantly evolving? How can we as a society nurture scientific curiosity?
Reason, revision, and responsibility. When Philosophy Talk continues.
Science is real.
Science is real, but how do we convince people to believe it? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about science and skepticism with professional skeptic Michael Shermer, author of Giving the Devil His Due, Reflections of a Scientific Humanist.
We are pre-recording this episode from our respective homes, and we can't take your phone calls. But you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website, where you can become a subscriber, gaining access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So earlier we were talking about why people don't always trust science. So, Michael, do you think that lack of trust in a scientific consensus is an individual problem, or do you think that society is designed in a way that makes that problem worse?
Oh, well, it's both for sure. And again, it depends on which particular claim we're talking about. Since you mentioned COVID and social isolation and masks and so on there, again, most of us don't understand the technical aspects of epidemiology and how that science is derived. Ditto climate science, it's a technical science. Who really understands it? So when people speak out publicly, really what they're doing is they're signaling, say, if they believe the science, that they accept science as a viable method of gaining reliable knowledge. And therefore they trust. It's not faith really, it's more confidence or trust from the experience of scientists being right and the self-correcting mechanisms of science and so on. When conservatives say they're skeptical, they don't understand the science either. Neither side understands the science very well. They're signaling publicly more their political commitment. So we know, for example, research on many of these fields that that scientific knowledge of a particular area is not a predictor of who accepts it. And as I said, most people don't understand climate science. So when I say I accept climate science, I accept global warming and so forth, really what I'm saying is I accept that science works and most of the time the consensus is right. So I'm acknowledging that system. And somebody who says I doubt it, that they're saying the opposite, at least for that area, because of politics.
So as an ordinary person who doesn't understand the ins and outs of climate science, how should somebody decide who to trust?
Yeah, so there we have the problem of which sources, and because in the modern age we have so many, essentially almost infinite number of sources online, you have to do some filtering. And therefore, the idea of scientific consensus, I think, needs to be more properly understood. It's not a democracy. We're not basing this argument on authority. We're acknowledging that the claims have already been vetted. That is what Popper described as conjecture and refutation as the scientific method. These conjectures have already been refuted or attempted to be refuted by professionals in the field. And by the time we consume it, say in the New York Times Tuesday Science section, it's already been filtered. And I can read with great confidence that, you know, the claims that are being made are probably true, not based on faith or authority, but because I know that the people that are making those claims have already been tested and debated and disputed and refuted, attempted to be refuted and so on. And that system works. I think we need to pound that more of how the system of science works, which to me is more important really than the facts themselves. That is, we should have confidence in it because the scientists themselves are trying to debunk each other.
I like that. I love the way you're describing science here, because it's, when we say trust the experts, we're not talking about reliance on authority. We're talking about a reliance on the system, the method of science. Just as you say, it's a kind of ecosystem where claims get tested and results are replicated. And so we can actually trust. It's not just trusting individuals. But the worry then is, what do we all do in a world where that very system, that very method is having doubt cast on it, right? Because so the philosopher T. Wen makes this nice distinction between the epistemic bubble and the echo chamber. So we're all in a little bit of a filter bubble where we see things that match our views, and that's a problem. But the bigger problem is the echo chamber, where even if you see a different claim, you immediately reject it, because it comes from the fake news, or it comes from those elites, or what do the scientists know? I feel it in my gut. You know, I've got a snowball in my hand that disproves it. So what can we do, yeah, right? I mean, I love the way I think you're 100% right about how science is this wonderful sort of self-regulating system. even if, of course, it's not always right, you have a better chance with it than anything else. But how do we convince other people of that?
Yeah, for a while I was discouraged about that, particularly for my job as a science educator and publisher of a scientific magazine, because of the so-called backfire effect. That is, people that believe something and you show them contradictory data, not only do they not change their minds, they double down on their beliefs and hold it even stronger. But those early studies, that was called the backfire effect, those early studies were not replicated, and new studies since then show that you can get people to change their minds, especially if it's presented in a way. Two factors here. First, if you present evidence visually, because we're a visual primate species. And so, you know, graphs and charts that are super easy to read, something that would be the equivalent of a USA Today level graph or chart that anybody can glance at and get it right away. Secondly, removing the political or religious or ideological component of the belief. So, for example, just analogously, I've debated creationists, you know, for my whole career. And you know, if you give a conservative Christian the choice between Darwin and Jesus, they're not picking Darwin. Okay, the argument's over before you even open your mouth. So you have to take Jesus off the table. You can accept Darwinian evolution without having to give up Christianity, without giving up your central core belief that you define yourself as, because no one's going to do that. And if you do that, then usually the denial of the science or the blinders fall off, and people can look at it and accept it because they don't have to give up something that's core to their beliefs. Same thing with climate change. When I talk to conservatives about it that are expressing doubt, you know, I try to convince them that that really a lot of free market conservative, you know, capitalists accept climate change. And in fact, they're capitalizing, if you will, on green technology and solar panels and electric cars. And Elon, I call it the Elon Musk argument, you know, that, look, you can be the next Elon Musk and make $1 billion selling green technology, you know, and that lots of people on their team accept the science, and that makes it okay. It's kind of a social acceptance or social signaling process.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about science and skepticism with Michael Shermer, founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. And we have an email from Emiliana in Berkeley. Emiliana says this: skepticism is built into the scientific method and a critical part of the process of vetting methods, analyses, and discoveries. Wholesale skepticism of science as an approach to human knowledge, however, feels extreme, harmful, and destructive. It defrays collective human trust. It bars important progress. No other model affords as much consensus or collaborative opportunity as science, imperfect as it is. Rather than claiming that science itself is wrong, skeptics of a science-backed claim should ask the question or seek evidence to justify whatever alternative stance they have. This is encouraged and in many ways the very point of science, which is meant to build on and revise itself over time. As we often say, when alternative explanations come up, that's an empirical question. How could we test it? So what do you think about that, Michael?
Yes, well, that is the key, empirical testing. So really what we're after here is a deeper question. How do you know what's true? You know, so people make this distinction, say, between science and faith or science and religion, or you hear this on the other side of, say, postmodernism, that there are many other ways of knowing. Well, okay, that's kind of true in a sense that there are different cultures or elements of culture that make up, and science is only part of that. Science isn't everything. But on the other hand, knowledge is knowledge. If you claim to believe in something, you know, it has some basis in fact, or it doesn't. Now, given that none of us are omniscient and we're not deities, no one knows for sure. So pretty much every decision we make about what to believe or not is made under uncertainty. And then you're into the realm of, well, this is what science does. That is, everything scientists do is made under uncertainty. So, you know, signal detection theory and statistical detection theory is all grounded on this idea of probabilistic truths, you know, truths with a small t, you know, apportioning your beliefs to the evidence, or as Carl Sagan liked to say, you know, the ICRE principle: extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And, you know, so everything we believe should be along those lines, not just things, facts, claims about nature, but about economics and politics and religion. I mean, these are all knowledge claims. I have no barriers there. There's no epistemological walls for me. You know, if you want to make a claim about progressive tax or regressive tax or some economic policy or some political, you know, the capital punishment or abortion or whatever. It's not that science can determine the final truth about these hotbed subjects, but it can at least inform them with knowledge. And so I think I'm kind of an epistemological universalist, you know, just apply science to everything and see how far we can go. And now it doesn't mean for sure we can know everything, but at least we can know something with some probability of confidence.
So one thing that I keep coming back to in your answers is this issue of trust. You've pointed out that I don't know all of the details of how, like, the scientific community around me has verified a claim or tested a claim or compiled evidence for and against. I have to sort of believe that they've not let me down. And most of the time, on average, that seems like a good belief, but, like, we've seen it fail in specific cases. So I was thinking about, like, the science of persuading people across political disagreements, and the name Michael LaCour came into my mind. So this was the graduate mm-hmm. student who sort of had this very high profile case of like persuasion on politically loaded topics such as gay marriage, where he claimed to have done mm-hmm. a bunch of survey experiments where the surveyor belonged to a group that was affected by a political decision, and it turned out that he just fabricated it. He just made up his data and hadn't yeah. done the study at all.
Right, you
do have people yeah. running around doing that. Like, how do you account for this, like, possibility that the scientific community might just let you down sometimes?
Well, they will. That does happen. I mean, fraud is pretty rare, you know, blatant. I made up the data. Some guy sitting there, you know, typing in numbers in his spreadsheet and presenting it as if he collected data. That does happen, but not very often. More importantly, how are those discovered? Well, it's by other scientists, or in this case, you know, graduate students or colleagues in the department, you know, whistleblowers, essentially, which is why we need to have whistleblower laws to protect whistleblowers, because that's how we find out. So when creationists, for example, point out mistakes that scientists made in the past about some fossil, and therefore we can't trust them. Well, first of all, none of the creationists discovered those errors. It was other scientists. So this attests to the self-correcting nature of science. But more importantly, the replication, so-called replication crisis, which appears to have happened mostly in the social sciences and the medical sciences, in part is due to the fact that a lot of these are really complicated experiments. They're difficult to replicate. And journals don't want replicated studies. They want original studies. And the publisher perish culture that we've created, you know, and this temptation there to therefore to push the envelope a little bit, and the file drawer problem where, you know, the non-significant studies just get filed away and we never hear about them, although those are important and so forth. But all of that I just described, that's all been described by scientists and philosophers of science and people that are in the scientific community. So all in an attempt to improve the gathering of reliable knowledge through science. So to those that doubt it, okay, fine, but what's the solution? It's better science. It's not let's abandon science. So the mechanisms for correcting those errors are all in place. We just have to be a little more vigilant.
We've got another email. It's from David in Portola Valley. And David says, since you got Michael Shermer signed up for this one, kudos on that. So you have a fan among our listeners.
He's the one. I'm sure
he's the one. Right, exactly. I'd like to hear some discussion of conspiracy theories versus science. Conspiracy theories are a special case of skepticism and one of extreme current interest. So Michael, what's the difference between a conspiracy theory or a form of pseudoscience and just bad science or just ordinary sloppy thinking?
Yeah, so first let's make a distinction between conspiracy theories and conspiracies. So a conspiracy is two or more people plotting in secret to gain an advantage morally or legally or whatever over a third party without their knowledge. So by that definition, there's lots of conspiracies. You know, most insider trading is a conspiracy, government agencies that do things without the approval of Congress or whatever that are illegal. That's a conspiracy. Watergate was a conspiracy. Iran-Contra was a conspiracy. So there's reasons people believe in conspiracies, because there's a lot of them that are true. You know, Volkswagen conspiring to cheat the emission standards, that's a conspiracy, right? So people have a right to be, you know, a little paranoid about powerful organizations, be they private corporations or government agencies, because we know this stuff happens. So the problem there now from there is, does that mean every, you know, conspiracy that someone like Alex Jones perpetrates, which, you know, is pretty much everything, is true? No, we have to be able to distinguish between true and false conspiracy theories. So I have a whole, you know, conspiracy theory detection kit that I've put together, you know, just questions to ask when you hear, like, how many people would have to be involved to pull this off? Because, you know, people can't keep their mouth shut, they're incompetent. You know, how many elements have to come together for this conspiracy to work? The more elements and people, the less likely it is to be true. What's the scope of the conspiracy theory? Is it, you know, most real conspiracies are very narrow in scope, you know, Volkswagen cheating the emission standards to make a profit, you know, there's nothing surprising about that. But, you know, people believe these things, A, because there's enough true conspiracies, and also the fear of, you know, power differentials. You know, we know that people in power do cheat systems, and that's not right. So we're extra paranoid about that for good reason, but that doesn't mean everything is true about them.
I really like the idea of considering what would have to be true in order for your alternative to a recognized consensus to hold, and then judging whether that's more or less likely than the recognized consensus. That sounds like maybe applicable to not just conspiracy theories, but any disagreement with a received view. Do you think that it's just sort of generally applicable?
Yeah, that's right. That's a great skeptical principle. If X is true, what else would have to be true? You need to just kind of carry it out as a thought experiment of sorts to see, you know, so for example, if, you know, the claim that someone saw Bigfoot in the hinterlands of Canada or the Himalayas or Washington State or whatever. Well, if that was true, what else would have to be true? Well, first of all, you'd have to have a large breeding population. You know, having one or two for the last two centuries that people have been talking about this, that can't be. There'd have to be a couple thousand at least. And if that were true, then there'd have to be some roadkills, some actual dead Bigfoot that somebody stumbles across on a hike. You know, something like that, we would by now have a dead body and so on and so forth. So therefore, that claim is likely to be not true.
I have amazing answers to this. No, I don't. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about science and skepticism with Michael Shermer, author of Giving the Devil His Due, Reflections of a Scientific Humanist.
Should scientists be doing more to talk to the public? Can science education be reformed? How do you talk to your COVID-denying relatives?
Opening minds and unwashing brains, when Philosophy Talk continues. Is it everyone for themselves, or is big science something we have to do together? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and our guest is Michael Shermer, founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. We're thinking about science and skepticism.
So, Michael, I'm sure we all have relatives who like to spout conspiracy theories, maybe Bigfoot theories at the dinner table. So what can we do about that, both as individuals and as a society?
Right. It depends on the claim, of course. As I said, you know, not all extraordinary claims are automatically false. Some might be true. So, I mean, just think of the story of Einstein and the resistance he met because of the kind of dogmatic nature of Prussian science at the time and the acceptance of Newtonian mechanics and whatnot. It took really about 15 years for his, you know, special and general theory of relativity to be accepted. So we can expect that kind of slowness in science. Science is conservative for a good reason, because most theories that people come up with, including scientists, are not right. They're incorrect, or they're wrong in some capacity. So now when you encounter a claim at the dinner table, say, You know, it's it's best not to just say that, you know, that's stupid or it's a bunch of baloney and be insulting. You know, everyone wants to be respected and listened to. Just think of yourself. So it's best to start off by just kind of asking questions. I think of it as kind of a Socratic method, or I sometimes I call it the Columbo method after the television popular television show Columbo, where he always asks
just one
questions
more
like just this one more thing. You know, he's kind of dragging it out of them until they finally confess to the crime. And but really it works because it gets people to think about how reliable their knowledge is. How did they arrive at that? You know, what was the source of that? Where'd you hear that? You know, and so if you do it in a way that's respectful, you make it possible and acceptable for them to change their mind. You're not condemning them for believing it at the moment. Also, it's unlikely anyone's going to change their mind right there at the dinner table. Like, oh my God, I never thought of that. I think I'll believe something else now. That rarely happens. Usually they, you know, go home and think about it for a while, maybe a few days later, a few weeks later, sometimes even years later, they go, you know what? I read your book or whatever, you know, 20 years ago, and I got to thinking, and now I'm a skeptic. Whenever I get these letters all the time. So it does happen. And again, back to cognitive research on this, people do change their minds. There's this meme floating about that really started with Kahneman and Tversky and their research on cognitive biases, which is all super interesting and important. But on the other hand, other scientists like Gert Gingerinzer and Hugo Mercier, his recent book is Not Born Yesterday, shows that, in fact, people do not just automatically default to truth and just automatically believe everything that they hear. They don't. We're pretty good skeptics if it's presented in such a way that it's, again, not challenging, it's not insulting, and, you know, you make it okay to change your mind without having to give up, you know, central core beliefs and that sort of thing. So there are good strategies there.
So we've got an email from Bob in Menlo Park, who says, skepticism seems to me the very essence of scientific thought. But one of the things I learned during that education, from going into proofs and evidence and being convinced, was to be skeptical of my own skepticism, to at least attempt to examine my own doubts with as much rigor as I read the latest partial results reported by people anointed experts by journalists. I learned along the way that my doubts and experts were at least as unreliable as the accounts I questioned.
Right. Well, good. That's fine. But of course, you know, you can't take this to the extreme where you believe nothing. You know, you never even get out of bed. We all believe lots of things and things that we, you know, have not investigated ourselves. I mean, you know, I accept quantum physics, but, you know, I don't know anything about it other than, the popular versions I read in books or see documentaries on TV shows. But, you know, the math, forget it. You know, I'm basing it on confidence that these people that work in this field have tried to debunk each other, and the stuff I consume has been filtered. Now, that doesn't guarantee it. It's true. I mentioned Einstein, you know, that, you know, when he came along, it was pretty well accepted that, 99.9% of the universe was totally explained by Newtonian mechanics. We're just kind of rounding out the sixth place after the decimal point. No, that turned out to be wrong. So occasionally that does happen, but that doesn't mean everyone's pet theory is the new paradigm shift that's going to happen. You know, people that are on the outside of science don't really understand this. They send me these long packages, big packages of long manuscripts, and they promise to share the Nobel Prize with me if I help them with the math. And it's usually related to physics and cosmology. You know, and Newton was wrong, Einstein was wrong, Stephen Hawking was wrong, Feynman was wrong, you know, take your pick. But they've worked it out in the garage here, you know, and I asked them, have you run it past like the local high school physics teacher or just somebody that, you know, that's in the field? Oh, no, they would never accept it because it's too radical, it's too revolutionary, and, you know, scientists are all closed-minded and so on. No, they're not. I mean, scientific revolutions do happen. It's just that they're conservative because most ideas are wrong.
So this actually brings me to another question that I have, which is about understanding science. So I might accept that probably the best thing to do in most cases is to defer to the scientific experts if I've got a question that they address. But in order to defer to them, I need to understand what they say. And this seems like especially hard in areas like physics. I'm just now also reminded of the crank who used to offer to pay people $1 million if they would refute his theory that nature was God's four-sided time cube. So one of the reasons that like you couldn't refute that guy was because I don't think he could understand your refutation. So how do I avoid being in that position?
Yeah, usually I suggest they check with the local physics teacher or somebody that could point out the problem. Usually it's hard to find the problem because they're so far outside the kind of realm of physics that they're working in that it's hard to point out. So I'll ask something like, well, how would you test that? Like, or what would it take to falsify your theory? And I point out the importance of falsification and Popperian science of conjecture and refutation. And you know, that's how it works. So, you know, let's think of a way to test your theory. Because most of these, what I call theories of everything, they're not testable. They're just assertions. And here, sometimes I invoke Christopher Hitchens' principle. I call it Hitchens' dictum. That is, that which can be asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. And this is sometimes called the burden of proof. Argument that is, the burden is not on me, the skeptic scientist, to debunk your alternative theory of whatever. It's on you to prove it to us because, you know, there's a million alternative theories of something out there. They're floating around all over. And, you know, we don't have time to test them all. You have to convince us. I got this grainy photo. Well, sorry, grainy photos don't constitute evidence, you know, and blurry videos. No, sorry. You know, you got to have something a little more concrete, like a body. You know, that's what I say that to the Bigfoot people too. Show me the body and I'll believe. You know, well, they used to doubt the existence of gorillas until the, you know, mountain gorilla was discovered in 1903. You know, that's just barely a century ago. Yeah, but they found it. There's a body, right? So that kind of, I think, you know, kind of epistemic confidence in a claim based on something concrete is a good place to start.
I still worry sometimes that we're in a kind of an asymmetric battle where we're so massively out. We're the little hobbits, you know, faced with the massive eye of Sauron because, you know, already in the 90s, the fossil fuel industry was spending millions of dollars casting doubt on science. Before that, it was tobacco. Now it's folks in various areas of the media casting doubt on things like climate change or COVID. We have this massive propaganda apparatus and we're these little hobbits. So is just asking these questions going to work? Is even, you know, we want to train people in critical thinking, but as you've pointed out, smart people can believe dumb things. I'm in a literature department. A lot of my colleagues believe that people only desire things because other people desired them first. So what do we do? I mean, should we use creative solutions? Like in the 19th century, magicians would debunk pseudoscience through magic shows. And, you know, are there creative things? Could we have a meta conspiracy theory, have a conspiracy theory about conspiracy theories? Well, what should we do since we're up against it?
Yeah. Well, magicians are still doing that. I mean, of course, there's Houdini and then the Amazing Randy. And now I meet a lot of young magicians today who are interested in skepticism and they can see that their skills are effective at showing people how easy it is to be fooled. Yes, I recall being on a Scientific American cruise where I was one of the guest lecturers. And at one of the dinners, a guy was telling me, well, I'm a skeptic, you know, I love your stuff. And, you know, but I saw this guy bend the spoon and he went into the whole thing. I knew where this was going. So as he's talking, I take the spoon off the table and I put it below the tablecloth and I bend it in the way he's describing that could not have possibly been done by mechanical means. And I said, you mean something like this? And he's like, oh crap. And so yes, that's very effective. Now, obviously that doesn't apply to everything like climate change or whatever, but for the most part, I'm reasonably confident that even so-called science deniers are not denying all of science. You got to drill down and find what is it that they're after. Even something like you mentioned conspiracy theories, like the 9/11 truthers, what are they really after? I mean, they can't possibly really believe that, you know, explosive devices were planted in the buildings and the planes were flowing into the buildings with remote control devices and so on. This goes on and on. Well, really, if you drill down and you talk to them, you know, they're really skeptical of big government agencies and big corporations and, you know, big pharma and big, you know, whatnot with the vaccines. You mentioned vaccines, big pharma, you know, so let's talk about that. And then you can kind of skirt around the specifics that they're hanging their general belief on and try to find out what they're really concerned about. You know, it's not perfect. We're always going to have these kinds of things going on. There's nothing new about that. You know, we're not really living in a post-truth world. It seems worse because of the internet, but really that, you know, people have dissembled and been confused and denied elements of science, you know, since science began. So that's not new. And politicians have always lied, and corporations and CEOs, they do cheat the system and so on. That's all been there for a long time. We have the tools to combat it. We just have to keep doing it.
Well, Michael Shermer, I'm a skeptic about a lot of things, but not about your brilliance. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, gosh, I don't know. I might be a little skeptical. I appreciate
Thanks again. Our guest has been Michael Shermer, founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine and a prolific author whose most recent book is Giving the Devil His Due, Reflections of a Scientific Humanist. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
So I think I share some of your, like, worries and temptation toward despair about, like, the sorry state of science communication in our world. But I really like the sort of suggestions and strategies that Michael has given us. Like, I don't see the point in not trying them. We should do everything we can to get people to sort of have the best possible shot at believing the truth.
100% agree. I really like his thought about having the insider speak the truth, right? Sometimes we've got people on, so to speak, the other side who are willing to say things that are actually true. But this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto, with apologies to Descartes, is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in the community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on the blog. Now, people say he talks fast, but where's the proof? It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, these days, skepticism itself is greeted with skepticism. I have seen with my own eyes words that say JFK Jr. is still alive and maybe Donald Trump's vice president in his second term, or that Tom Hanks is part of a global child sex ring because he was in a movie with red shoes, which is code for, hey, everybody, I'm part of a global child sex ring. If you doubt that or ask for proof of some kind, you become part of the problem, a sinister cabal of deniers right there in the hip pocket of George Soros or Hillary Clinton. Or if you want to leap to the other side of those beliefs, the hip pocket of the Koch brothers, Goldman Sachs, the deep state, the one world conspiracy, not even denial. Mild uncertainty can mark you as complicit in crimes which do not even have a name yet. There are no skeptics, just heroes and victims. I have seen both fears of and threats of armed revolt come election time, either from Antifa or Boogaloo Boys, depending on who wins, not even then. Everybody seems convinced some kind of civil war is imminent, the only uncertainty being where it will be fought exactly. Right now, it seems confined to a couple blocks in Portland and Seattle. Some have been trying to implant anarchy as a major national threat, but it's not really playing out as it should. Efforts to turn Chicago, for example, and New York into cesspools of violence run amok have been thwarted by statistics. And even simply, people reading the Sunday New York Times over coffee in Central Park, they are not skeptical. They are simple disbelievers. The evidence of their own eyes overwhelms them. Others, however, from the comfort of their faraway hovels, totally believe that Joe Biden, for instance, is a pawn in the clever young hands of AOC. Others believe that Trump is either a pawn of Putin, a pawn of a vast centuries-old conspiracy, or a player of 5D chess. Or is that 5G chess? 5G chemtrails and pandemic hoaxes being the latest focuses for our lost certainties. Are we blowhards and yahoos firing weapons into the air, or a gradually weakening woke country about to turn everybody else's weapons into plowshares, whether they like it or not? The answer, of course, is yes. Rumors quickly become fact unless forgotten, and it no longer matters. Each crime is a certainty, though the process of naming is subjective. Murder one, murder two, manslaughter, assault with a deadly weapon, innocence is something else. Thanks to Christianity, you can be innocent even when guilty. Uneasy moral states are how churches boost attendance, how capitalism gets your money. But that's got nothing to do with doubt. We can be certain that there's a name for each folly we are accused of committing, and that name will be true, though we ourselves be not. Virtue, on the other hand, is slippery. If sometimes you need a priest or a lawyer or a mom to tell you the difference between right and wrong, sometimes a slippery slope is just a straight line gone wrong. On the other hand, if our certainty is mainly being fortified by uncertain premises, if we wield skepticism like a sword to reinforce what we choose to believe, throwing science, best practices, experience, terms of art out the window and onto a wall of our own devising, we can be certain that forensics will continue to stick. So long as we have fingerprints, blood, DNA, solid police work, entomology, anthropology, lawyers, and true crime fans, we will work together to figure out who done it until the day comes when, you know, who cares who done it, really? Guilt and innocence are your red wagon. I just want this whole thing over so I can look for a job. In this vein, I keep thinking about the former Republican Representative Trey Gowdy, who led something like 8 Benghazi hearings. No wrongdoing by Hillary Clinton was ever found. I had seen Trey Gowdy as a civilian prosecutor several times on TV's Forensic Files. He seemed to have an amazing command of forensic tools, ending in successful convictions. So either he was a lot less competent than we thought, or Hillary's a lot more slippery than we thought, or both. Maybe it's time for another hearing. Have one every year, like the groundhog seeing his shadow. Alas, Maybe the truth about Benghazi is like, who was Jack the Ripper? What did Billy Joe throw off the Tallahatchie Bridge? Who put the ram in the Ramalama Ding Dong? Nobody will ever know. Put all your guesses as fact on the op-ed page. Why not? Nobody will ever again, ever, ever know. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2020.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program did not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
These were all the smartest scientists on the planet. Only problem is, they kept being wrong. Sometimes.